Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Simon Brown. Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss joins me this evening to guide us through all the latest news on global markets. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Adrian Saville from Canon Asset Managers to discuss their Global Champions portfolio. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making headlines. Amazon has purchased online pharmacy PillPack for around $1 billion. While the announcement cost pharma sector investors $19 billion, Amazon gained about $5 billion in value. PillPack has pharmacy licenses in all 50 states, giving Amazon the ability to ship prescriptions around the country. This move makes Amazon a direct threat to the over $400 billion pharmacy sector. Company CEO Jeff Bezos is already in the process of creating a healthcare company, along with JP Morgan and Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. In the banking sector, Deutsche Bank's U.S. subsidiary failed the second part of the Fed's annual stress tests. This due to widespread and critical deficiencies in its capital planning controls. Failing the stress test means Deutsche Bank will need to make substantial changes and will not be able to make any distributions to its German parent company without the Fed's approval. Deutsche Bank's peers, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, were not unscathed. They have been ordered to strengthen their balance sheets by freezing dividends and share buybacks. And deals involving media companies, including the bidding war for Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox, helped drive worldwide merger and acquisition activity to new highs in the first half of 2018. He has more on that.
We're only halfway through the year, but already a series of mega deals, including the bidding war for 21st Century Fox, has seen the global value of M&A activity hit $2.5 trillion. That's up 64% year on year, making it the strongest period since records began in 1980.
The fact that money is very cheap, and certainly that is a really big factor in supporting the level of M&A. But I think there are other factors at play here too. Now, first of all, there's been some really big deals as well. And that's one thing that's really skewing this data.
Much of those eye-watering sums were paid by media conglomerates looking to strengthen their position in an increasingly crowded market. So far in 2018, their deals have totaled more than $320 billion, six times as high as the same period last year. Another big driver has been divestitures by large corporations. Earlier this week, General Electric announced a sweeping breakup plan to divest $20 billion worth of assets.
What would be quite interesting is to know to what extent a fear that the cost of money is going to rise had an impact on M&A this quarter. It's quite possible that firms wanted to get deals done because they're anticipating that money won't be this cheap for so long.
But geopolitical risk could dampen movement in the back half. Already, trade tensions are playing a part, with US President Donald Trump using national security grounds to block chipmaker Broadcom's proposed takeover of Qualcomm.
Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss joins me now. Gary, thanks for joining us on the desk. Before we get to some news, Friday was, well, quarter end, half year end. S&P up 1.7, about 3%, including dividends for the year. In truth, frankly, not bad. I mean, it's sort of 6 or 7 if we annualized. It's not unreasonable. But after the stonking 2017, I think a lot of investors are probably like, hey, who ate my return?
Yeah, exactly right. So looking at 2017, you kind of had to, you know, almost do expectation management of every client that was, you're like, yes, you've been invested in either, you know, the Vanguard S&P 500 tracker, or you've taken an offshore portfolio. And yes, you're up, you know, over 20% in dollars, you know. Do not expect this to continue, because it can't. I mean, you know, if you look at kind of the inflation that we're getting in the US, I mean, yes, we understand that a lot of these companies, you know, maybe late stage bull market, you know, helping to fuel it a little bit, you know, tax cuts also putting a little bit of a boost on earnings. But the fact when you've got low inflation, technological gains can only get you so far. And as those PEs start kind of re-rating higher, you know, there is cause for concern. And I mean, to see kind of the volatility returning a little bit, to see, you know, stocks fluctuating backwards and forwards, it's kind of more return to normal than anything else, I think.
That's a good point. Return to normal and not to be sniffed at. You know, when things go up in a straight line, it's nice if you bought on day one, not so nice if you kind of came in. At least at this point, we're getting opportunities. Some stocks are coming back. You can buy something. They move. We look a little bit clever. There's more opportunities. It is, as you say, I mean, we've gone 108 days since the S&P 500 all-time high. I quipped before we came on air. We probably actually had about that many highs last year. Normality is kind of almost refreshing in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you get the sense of panic from investors as well. You know, oh, you know, the portfolio is down a little bit, portfolio is moving up a little bit. But if you actually look at kind of the straight line for the year, it's not terrible. I mean, as you say, a couple of opportunities presenting themselves. And yeah, I think what maybe has people concerned is there's so much of this return is also just coming from Amazon, which is unreal. And I mean, you know, you look back though at even 2017, and I mean, when you were looking at kind of the halfway point where we are now, I had to do an exercise for a client where we were looking at just the FANG stocks and how much they contributed to the overall, you know, kind of performance of U.S. markets, and it's significant. And I mean, we've got to understand that the kind of tech boom is what's driving these U.S. markets at the moment, and you know, kind of the more traditional counters, you know, your Procter and Gamble's, your kind of, you know, like consumer staples are really suffering. You know, the oil and gas as well, even with the higher oil prices, haven't recovered to levels where they used to be. So this is very much a tech and consumer driven rally that we're seeing in the US.
Yeah, you mentioned Amazon. They bought PillPack. We talked about that in the intro for about $1 billion. PillPack essentially delivers prescription drugs via the mail. They're in all 50 states. Nice little business. $1 billion, which is truthfully a little bit small, but pharma stocks got killed in the process. I mean, frankly, I can see why you would be scared of Amazon. But I mean, is it, you know, Amazon, and we've talked about it before, is an absolute beast. Pretty much everything they've gone into, they've had some hardware that perhaps hasn't been a storming success. But they, you can see how they can really take this business on. And $400 billion business, this is real.
It is. And if you look at it again, it's going to be the potential for Amazon to roll it out to their clients, and the idea of them, you know, delivering the medication just about for everyone. So if you look at, you know, kind of the Facebook deal that we saw when it bought WhatsApp, everyone was saying, oh, you know, per subscriber that you're buying on WhatsApp, you know, that's a crazy price to pay for anything. But then, you know, suddenly you see sort of 30 million subscribers turn into 1 billion subscribers very, very quickly. And I think that's kind of the what you're buying into when you buy into the concept that Amazon entering kind of the pharmaceutical and pharmaceuticals in the sense, more, you know, drug delivery, drug logistics, which is what PillPack does. That's where they're going to take the business. Now, if you kind of actually do some digging, you listen, I mean, and the competitors are not necessarily the big pharma. So it's not Pfizer you're really competing against. It's the Walgreens Boots Alliance. It's the Rite Aid, CVS Health, for example. It's kind of the pharmacy outlets that you should be concerned about. Now, if you kind of listen to the CEOs, I'm sure they're talking their book, but they're kind of pointing out that the pharmaceutical business is a lot more complex than just logistics. I mean, you go to a pharmacy to pick up your pills, but there's a lot more that goes into pharmacy that, you know, perhaps Amazon hasn't looked at, in enough detail. Again, you go back to Amazon's track record as well, and in 1999, they tried this before, where they moved into the you know, I suppose, what you call pharma logistics sector, and they ended up selling it to Walgreens Boots Alliance, who eventually closed the business down, I think, in 2016. So it's, you know, it is a difficult space, and I think the declaration that Amazon is moving there, it should be a major concern. And I think you will see a repricing of a lot of those pharma outlet type companies. But, you know, I think this is, the game is far from over. And I think, you know, to just plow all the money into Amazon at this stage and ignore the rest of the kind of the retail distribution sector, and to ignore Walmart as well, which I think we talked about last time.
We absolutely did.
Yeah, Walmart also had a, you know, from kind of the rumors on the street, Walmart also had a bid in for PillPack, and Amazon kind of beat them in the price and managed to get in there. But, you know, it remains to be seen how this deal is going to spin.
Yeah, take nothing away from Amazon. This isn't a straight line, you know, dead cert. There's a lot of complexities there. With complexities, Tesla finally get into their targets, doing 5,000 Model 3s in a week. I got to be honest, I didn't think they'd get there. I mean, they had to at some point, I suppose. The problem with Tesla, yeah, by all accounts, great cars. By all accounts, a great / slightly crazy CEO. My concern is, I mean, is it in an investment case? I mean, are you putting clients into it? Is it on a recommended list?
No, it's not. It's not on a recommended list. We've got clients that hold it against the recommendation. but I mean, that's the nature of stockbroking. So it's not one that we all hold in managed portfolios either. And the concern has always been around the valuation. Yet I love the story.
No, we want it to succeed.
Don't get me wrong. I listen to every single Tesla earnings call that comes out, and I do a lot of research into the company. I just am not yet convinced to buy, because as you said, 5,000 Model 3 cars. I think they produced 7,000 cars in a week.
Yeah.
And I think the Ford CEO got on Twitter and said, yes, we also do 7,000 cars per hour.
Per hour.
And it just shows the scope and the difference. And I mean, you know, you kind of listen to Elon Musk, and I mean, you know, he is kind of, you know, famous, infamous for hitting targets as well. I mean, yes, maybe on the production, it's been a little bit backwards. But, you know, he'll go and bet Australia that they can't build, you know, giant batteries and then deliver. Now, you know, and one of the criticism that he always puts out on the earnings call is, you know, what Tesla's growth is parabolic. I mean, it's kind of taking off. And, you know, if you're trying to say at the end of the second quarter, we're going to deliver this many cars, you know, if you're out by a couple of days either way, it's going to make a massive difference to the numbers. So it's very difficult to predict these things. So, you know, kind of we'll make our estimates. And I think he's now saying next year,
yeah,
he'll be up to 6,000. But, you know, it's very difficult. And kind of, you know, you've got to look at the story in a wider context. And I think one of the concerns that I've got to mention around the stock as well is the way that they've hit this 5,000 Model 3 target. It's one of the reasons I think we're a little bit concerned. So in the last earnings call, you had him kind of saying, you know, we've got a very, they call it the alien dreadnought, which is their machine that builds the machines. And he was just saying, just be, you know, at the moment we've been kind of all focused on automating everything. And what we've done now is we've realized we actually have to take a step back. We have to look at this and say, you know, like I think the example he gave was, it's a piece of fluff that sits on top of a battery. And he says, in the past, we spent a huge amount of money trying to develop a little robot to lift this fluff off and put it on the battery. Some jobs are just better done by humans. You know?
There's hope for us still.
And that was one of the examples. So they've kind of right-sized it, but it's not kind of in the old Tesla model of, you know, build a giant automated, you know, self-thinking machine. It's kind of like they you know, to I don't want to say it, but I mean, they essentially cut corners to make this target as well. I mean, there's talks of, you know, converting car parks to extra production lines and all sorts of things. And I mean, this is obviously because the stock's under pressure. He's already sort of issued an open social media challenge to all short sellers that they're going to burn on Tesla as well. So we're not short Tesla, we just don't own it.
Point is, he did it. Whether he had to do some fluff or not, quickly to loop back to Amazon before we go to break, European supermarkets, Tesco, I think it's Carrefour, I'm not sure, maybe you. Strategic alliance, not much detail, but seemingly there's going to be a sort of a purchasing agreement. And this makes sense, and particularly Amazon's obviously not as big in Europe, but it's there. But sort of hooking up in some places, not so much on the distribution side, and this can maybe get some pricing down and help compete against the online.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at Tesco, I mean, even, you know, when I was in London 10 years ago, I mean, we had our groceries delivered by Tesco, you know, to your door. I mean, it was all done online already. And in a sense, you know, online retail in terms of your kind of grocer in the UK is a lot further ahead than you would expect in South Africa. But looking at it, I mean, it makes perfect sense. These are both, you know, kind of the juggernauts on each of the different economies on the continent. Carrefour, you know, the largest. Tesco, at least the largest retailer in Europe, at least in the UK. And and to kind of combine that buying power, it's something that they've talked about for about 3 years now. And I think it's all hopefully going to benefit the consumer in the end of the day, as you know, lower costs will hopefully drive through lower prices, and all thanks to competition.
Yeah, and to your point of earlier, it's this you know, technology, this isn't technology, can actually take us quite far, and hence we're seeing, for a bunch of reasons, crazy inflation. Short break. When we come back, we'll take a look at Cannon Asset Manager's Global Champions Portfolio with Adrian Saville. Stay tuned. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio, Gary Boyson from Rand Swiss, joining to discuss Cannon Asset Manager's Global Champions Portfolio, Adrian Saville. Adrian, thanks for joining us on the desk.
Thank you.
Next kickoff, we chatted a month, maybe 6 weeks ago. I think you were at an airport somewhere. And you were saying before we came on, that was your sort of your passive space. And now this is the other end of the curve, which is the active space. And it's almost being agnostic. And you're saying to the investor, you make the call, which or the blend that you want, and we can help in that space.
To us, that makes a lot of sense. You know, we think many people get caught in the middle, and it's, you know, sort of trying to be all things to everyone. You land up with a portfolio that often looks very much like the market and incurs active fees, so you get index performance with active fees, and the net result is disappointing. So we build at Cannon Asset Managers what we call a barbell approach, and on the one end of the bar are portfolios that are passive. They own the underlying asset classes through indices. You know, there's a place to, I think, be intelligent about the way you build indices, so perhaps replacing a market-weighted index with an equal-weighted index, but then getting all of the fees out of the portfolio process. And then right on the other end of the barbell is this very active suite where we build a portfolio to look different than the market. You should expect different than market performance. And if we do well, we will earn our different than market fees.
and highly concentrated. The one thing I noticed, I mean, typically when I chat to these sort of funds, it's anywhere, I don't know, 60, 70, 80, 100 plus sort of stocks. You're coming with 30. I had a chatting with someone from Investec a week or two ago. They had 42, and I thought that was concentrated.
Yeah.
30 stocks, high conviction, high concentration, go big or go home.
You know, I wouldn't say it's go big or go home. This is a very carefully constructed, well-diversified portfolio across industries, geographies, currencies. The companies that we invest in are well-established, you know, well-funded, well-run, and we acquire those businesses at good prices. The fact that it's a concentrated portfolio results in us building and owning a portfolio that we know what's in there.
Fair point.
You know, you're hard-pressed once you're into 30 or 40-something to be able to name what you own. And if you are in 30 or 40-something, you've often diversified away all of your company-specific risk. So we are, by design, concentrated, and we know what we own.
You know what you own, and you leave it for client. Your level, Gary, would you go so concentrated? Do you in your segregated?
Yeah, we do go that. And one of it, I suppose, is also just, you know, especially if you do have segregated portfolios, I mean, it's the fees as well. You can't you know, sort of track 500 stocks in a portfolio. Your minimum balance has just become ridiculous. But yeah, I'm interested maybe to ask, you know, with the level of concentration and as you say, you know, the depth of understanding you can have in those individual companies, obviously managing kind of at arm's length, you know, managing at a distance like you guys, I assume, are, it's very different from running a portfolio in the local market where you can attend results presentations, you go for lunches with CEOs, that kind of thing. How do you, you know, can you take me through a little bit of the investment process and how that differs from perhaps a local strategy?
Our investment process starts with top-down, which is using a set of factors to sort of screen out businesses that aren't of interest to us, and that might be because of liquidity, the company's track record, balance sheet structure. So there's a range of factors that will immediately take our investable universe from 10,000 down to something more manageable. And the process then, you know, once we're into the arena of identifying a set of companies, I think one of the attributes of Cannon's portfolios is that we truly define ourselves or describe ourselves as investors. You know, I don't mean we buy to hold and never review the position, but the turnover in our portfolios translates into holding average holding periods of, in our international portfolio, global portfolio, 10 years. And that allows us to really get to know the businesses that we're invested in well. And sure, you might not get to have lunch with the CEO, but I'm not sure if any New York investors or Wall Street investors are having lunch with the CEO of BlackRock. Mm. So the fact that you are more remote in South Africa, I don't think that gongs us out. Perhaps it gives us a distance or a perspective, which is a vantage point. And then we have access to the same data suites, the same sell-side analysts, and the same company conferences and research.
And the 10-year holding period, what that would imply to me is that you find a quality company and you care about the price at the purchase point. Thereafter, you're largely agnostic to price. I mean, Procter & Gamble, big holding, under pressure. If anything, that's a buy. Inversely, if it runs hard, you might lighten just for weighting purposes, but you're not going to say, well, it's expensive, let me take my money off the table. You're going to say, it's quality, I stay there.
Keeping in mind also that the portfolio we're describing here, we build for individual investors.
Sure.
And every time you transact in an individual's portfolio, you're incurring a transaction cost.
Tax implication.
Which is the client's money.
Yeah. I wanted to come to a point that you're talking. You mentioned that it's very much that you start top down, and you look what we are seeing. I mean, we're Turkish elections this weekend, a very left winner. We've got President Trump and on off or seemingly on trade wars, etc., etc. Are you taking a more cautious or more nervous view, or is this to your mind perhaps opportunity, or just look at different areas?
There's some stocks in the portfolio that have, I think, been clearly victims of Trump war. BMW is a great case in point, where BMW, you can now buy the business on a 6x earnings multiple. It's quite staggering given the performance of the business, its return on asset, return on equity, profitability, the fact that China is now its largest market segment. But investors have taken a very, very cautious view. I think in a bolder portfolio, we would probably add to BMW at this juncture. But it's a diversified portfolio. So if there are trade wars, or if Turkey goes pear-shaped, we expect some part of the portfolio to hurt whilst others will be compensated. So there's a defensive component that's actually doing really nicely in the portfolio. If you look through one of the holdings, SoftBank, which is the Japanese listed holding company, its largest asset is Alibaba. And Alibaba is having a fantastic time, despite Trump's best efforts. So this really is, when we talk about diversification, it's not just names, it's diversification across currencies, industries, geographies.
You mentioned geographies, and whenever I get these fact sheets, I usually get a very pretty picture telling me the geographies. And I usually think, okay, so Apple's America, except it's not. I mean, yes, some of it is. SoftBank, as you say, is a Japanese company, but they've got American assets. They got Chinese assets. Yeah. You actually said to me before we came on, you actually look through to the currencies, because that gives you a truer reflection of where these companies are generating returns.
Exactly. If you buy Snam Spa, for instance, which is the Italian natural gas energy business, you're getting euro earnings. It's a euro client. It's very much Italian. But if you're buying SoftBank or BMW, SoftBank has got some Alibaba in China. It's got some Sprint in the United States. BMW is global revenue. Intel is global revenue. And for that reason, we peel away the mask of geography and look through to currency to know where our revenue is coming from. I think that's the essence of building a global portfolio.
A last point before we finish. I mean, when I look at your top 10, Procter & Gamble, Nestle, Swiss Re, BlackRock, BMW, some names that spring out me, some names, truthfully, more than half I'd never heard of before. And your point says, these companies you're looking at are not necessarily sort of global in their reach or footprint. They might not be the biggest. They might not be Apple. You're looking for the best. And that best one might be a small little business in a smaller territory. Again, it goes back to quality rather than just saying, well, we've got to own the FANGs, we've got to own the Teslas or whatever. It's finding the right ones regardless of size and location.
I suppose, as much as I desperately wish we had owned lots and lots of FANGs, or maybe only FANGs for the last couple of years, I think investing always is about just getting a couple of things right, and it's about buying good businesses, good assets, paying the right price for them, and letting time then do its magic. So, they may not be the biggest, they may not even be the best, but they are good. And owning this portfolio of good assets at good prices, we think that makes for a great investment.
Gary, one of the hardest things must be, as someone at the coalface, is that time thing. We mentioned it before Adrian came on. Truthfully, your investors want to be rich by Friday, this Friday, and you've got to say to them, this is a process.
Yeah, it's interesting, but I certainly find it, I don't know how you find it, but our offshore investors are a lot more sticky, a lot more relaxed as well. And I think maybe, again, it comes down to that distance. It's once you've moved the funds offshore, once you're invested in big, good quality businesses, you can handle a level of volatility without panicking. You look at some of the market caps, and I'm looking here, the market caps of these companies, they're bigger than, a lot of top 40 components. Yeah. Some of them are bigger than the whole top 40 put together. And that's kind of, I suppose, it adds a level of safety and a level of comfort to investors that are looking to invest offshore.
We're out of time. Adrian, my favorite quote, good business plus good price equals good investment. I like that. We'll leave it there. That's the show for this week. Thanks to our guests, Gary Boyson, Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Adrian Saville, CEO of Canon Asset Managers. Thanks to you for watching. I'll catch you same time, same place next week. Have a good evening.